downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. This week on the Missouri Review Sound Booth, Missouri Review intern Joelle Jeffress leads a roundtable discussion about Read Women 2014, a Twitter campaign initiated by writer Joanna Walsh that encourages people to read women writers this year. In the roundtable, Joelle talks with Missouri Review's associate editor Evelyn Summers, McClaskey Fellow in Social Media Allison Belaskiewicz, contest editor Mike Petrick, and University of Missouri professor Trudy Lewis about the Read Women 2014 campaign, as well as other issues of gender in literature.
Welcome, everyone. I'm here joined by Evelyn Summers, Mike Petrick, Allison Belaskiewicz, and Trudy Lewis to talk about the Read Women 2014 Twitter campaign and other campaigns as well to encourage more reading of women in literature. Everyone's kindly joined me on their own free time. But just to start off, is this a good, necessary idea? Evelyn, would you like to... Sure. What do you think of Read Women 2014?
Yeah. I'll start the ball rolling here. I was thinking about this last night, your first question about whether it's a good and necessary idea. And I remembered that as a high school student, for whatever reason, I went on a binge for about a year of reading only African-American literature. And what started it, I have no idea. But I was thinking comparatively of, you know, the value there is in sort of immersing yourself in one group of writers, getting familiar with that group, and really trying to get a lens or a perspective to view the particular group that you're reading. So it was valuable to me then. I think there's nothing wrong with deciding you're going to read a particular gender or ethnicity or whatever it might be for a period of time. You know, it's research, isn't it, in a sense? Not just pleasure, but finding out about something. So yeah, I think it's... I was going to do that a couple years ago, and then I backed out because I wanted to read Brazzaville Beach by William Boyd, and so I didn't keep my vow to read only women that year, but maybe I'll do it in 2014.
Allison?
Well, I do think it's necessary. Do you mean the Twitter campaign alone, or just reading women in general?
The campaign, maybe the active encouragement of it, but also...
Well, yeah, I believe that as a campaign, it works as a way of raising awareness that there is an issue and there is a problem, not just in our reading habits, but also in publishing trends. What we do with that tool after the awareness has been raised, I suppose, is a more pertinent question.
Yeah, and it's obviously very easy to just kind of hit the share button on your Twitter account, so it's a really easy thing, but I think it's speaking to something that's, you know, been identified as a clear problem with through the Vita account, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. So, you know, it's speaking to a clear issue, mm-hmm. and awareness is good for that. And it's, I think, generating a lot of conversations, which is good, even if, you know, it's easy to quickly share that and then maybe not mm-hmm. follow through with it. It's at least getting people's eyes on that idea and getting people talking about it.
What's interesting is how much... relevance it's had to the literary community, not just people who are in publishing or writers themselves, but also just people who identify primarily as readers, and that they've really joined onto this and it's really resonated with them in some way. So in a sense, it's joining both the writers and the publishers to the readers and seeing, I mean, if we're looking at this from a corporate perspective, what the consumer wants as well and what they're interested in.
And I think one of the issues, as I understand it, of this campaign is not just about reading women, but about the fact that women writers are not given the same degree of respect isn't the word I want there, but you know what I mean. They're not held up as models of our best writers mm-hmm. in the U.S. and probably the mm-hmm. U.K. too. And so they're not reviewed as mm-hmm. much. And that's been going on for a long time. When we used to do individual reviews at the Missouri Review, and I would spend a lot of time looking, reading reviews regularly, it didn't take very long to realize that, say, the New York Times isn't reviewing women in anywhere near the same numbers as it is men, and that really, it's gotten better, but it hasn't, it's not perfect, a perfect quality at this point. So people do read women, but whether they're rated as highly, you know, that's another question. As I understand it, that's more what the campaign is about mm-hmm. than actually getting people to read books by women authors.
It is puzzling because women have such a long tradition of success in the literary arts, and especially in the novel and the short story, which interests me. And looking back to Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, I think we're still dealing with the same problems. It's puzzling. Women are writing. In many of my graduate workshops, there are more women than men. Women are the majority of readers, and women have a great history of success in the literary arts. And I, following along with Woolf, I tend to have a material analysis of it, who has the money and who's willing to spend the money. And if women do have money, often it comes to them through a patriarchal source. So their loyalty may lie in that direction, even though they're biologically women. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have to deal with the question of who's a woman. I mean, do we look to biology? Do we look to how people identify? You know, even if we look to biology, there's a lot of complication in that. So it's problematic once you start to look at it theoretically. Mm-hmm. But as a campaign, I'm behind it.
So do you think this is the best way of following on from the difficulties of what is woman and representation in general across it? Is focusing solely on women authors the best way to progress to raise this representation, or do you think there are other ways that we can look into changing the dominant figures that the Vita seem to show of white male authors?
I mean, I think it's having an all the above approach is probably the best way to tackle this sort of thing. Yeah. So this sort of a Twitter campaign can really do no harm, is kind of the way I see it. It can only do good things, and really it's promoting diversity, which, sure, as many of us are going to say, we really feel like that's super important. I'm reading diverse authors, and this is one example of that, but it's promoting diversity, period. And I think that, you know, having a sort of an all of the above campaign to do that is a good idea.
I think it really depends on what our goal is. If the goal is to have women equally represented with men, I think that's an admirable goal. That's not my personal goal, if it just goes to support liberal humanism and capitalism, but, you know, I'd be for it. I mean, it would be better than not to have women be represented. But I think that I as a reader also look to what people are writing about and how mm-hmm. they're writing about it. And that would include people other than women. For example, Caleb Crane's recent novel, Necessary Errors. He writes about a gay man who goes to Prague, and he's out in America, but he's not out in Prague. And there's an incredible observation on each page about gender and social interactions. And I think if you really want to investigate the question, you'd read those kinds of novels as well.
So it's saying that it's not just the name on the spine, but also the content in the story.
Well, you have to consider that also in the 19th century, so many women authors, like George Eliot, the name was the male name, you know?
Well, even with J.K. Rowling, I mean, she published under her initials because they didn't believe that a woman could, you know, sell a story about a young boy to young boys, that they would be so appalled that a woman wrote that, so.
Right, and George Eliot has a famous essay trashing female novelists called, I think it's Silly Novels by Silly Women Novelists, is that the title of it? And probably most of the novels she's writing about in that essay are bad novels, but it didn't help the cause of women's respectability and authority as writers. I think Trudy's right that the content's very important, and I do have a concern about things like the Vita count, which is undoubtedly valuable. It really points fingers, you know, and it points out numbers that are meaningful, but at the same time, what are the particular novels or stories about, or, you know, whatever it is that's getting published. Is it, does it have to do, are we talking about, for example, books, stories, essays that deal with women's experience, or are we talking about sometimes fiction or nonfiction that plays to male readers as much as it does to female readers, that's about, that isn't maybe necessarily representative of gendered experience. I think that's a concern that I have.
Yeah, and along with that, I mean, I think that there's a real prevalence of attitudes that women write certain things and men write certain things, and, you know, I think maybe that's a little bit less common in academia, but certainly I have students who come in with that who say, oh, I only identify with male protagonists, so I don't want to read a book by a female writer, and, you know, that's problematic in a number of ways. Or similarly, students who will say something like, I only want to read action stories, or I only like the action, I don't like the love story. And there's this weird dichotomy that's kind of been set up just in terms of narrative arcs that seems pretty false to me. You know, I teach a sci-fi course, and I hear that a lot from sci-fi students who come in really loving the genre, and they say, you know, I'm in it for the action, not the love story, so I read a lot of male sci-fi authors. And, I mean, something as simple as, like, Star Wars, even if it is maybe somewhat fantasy rather than sci-fi, you know, I watch that for the love story as much as anything, and it's silly to kind of make these divides. And I think through something like this, we can get people reading more diverse things. And as you guys have talked about, like, more diversity, period, I think is a good idea. And it's not just about the name on the cover, but also about the attitudes that are espoused within, and the, you know, the protagonists too. I mean, I think there is something to be said for young men reading strong female protagonists. You know, I think that can have a positive effect.
But young men may really resist that. You know, I have a 16-year-old son, and he's a great reader, a really strong reader, and likes to read classics and asks repeatedly for more recommendations for books. But what I've discovered is that he's not always interested. In fact, he's definitely not interested at this point in reading books about female characters or by female characters. And one book that I've been pushing on him for a long time now is the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, because I know it's a novel he would enjoy. It's a wonderful novel. You know, anybody would like this novel, and it's good. It's a good book for his reading level's high, but he's still 16 after all. There's a lot that happens in that novel, and it's continually interesting. But something is stopping him from picking that up, and it's not my recommendation, because I've recommended other books he's picked up, and I'm quite convinced it's the title Miss Jane Pittman that tells him it's about a woman, and not only a woman, but Miss Jane, and he doesn't want to read about her, having decided already that that experience is not going to be very interesting to him. So so far I haven't been able to make him take the plunge on that one. So I think that happens, that young men don't want to read about women.
I've been thinking about this in the context of the recent young adult books, mm-hmm. The Hunger Games and Divergent, and I'm actually a pretty big fan of those two works, even though I don't read a lot of young adult in general. But the thing those two books have in common is they have female protagonists that young male readers identify with. And I think that's really fantastic. And my son even read The Hunger Games, and he wasn't interested in reading it at the time, so I was thrilled. But the downside of that is I think they're appealing because they're both warrior figures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're warlike, and they're violent, and they can be cruel. And so that's an interesting question. So men, is it that male readers can identify with female characters if they have these male traits? And are those the masculine traits that we really want to encourage?
It's interesting because I'm a big fan of young adult works, because I think they quite often end up exploring a lot of social issues that aren't necessarily addressed in adult ones, because they're introducing them to younger people. And I was trying to think through along the lines of what a strong female protagonist, and yes, I came up with Katniss in The Hunger Games, but I was thinking of a book that I've spoken to with a lot of female friends and a lot of male friends with a female protagonist, and that is Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, and they have it's Lyra, isn't it, as a female. And she isn't too warlike, but she is very strong. But I wonder if the difference there is she's the whole point is she's prepubescent, she is a child, so whether that is easier for people because almost children are so often considered almost genderless in those sort of aspects.
And there is sort of a history of young female children going on adventures like Alice in Wonderland or Wendy and so on and so forth, and they can sort of fulfill those roles. But I wonder about The Hunger Games with Katniss, or I haven't read Divergent or seen the movie, but I wonder if partially why young boys don't want to read about young women is because they're sort of sold this image that a woman not only is interested in love tales, but that she, you know, the ideal woman is still in our social consciousness a passive figure. She's the one who has things done to her, and that perhaps this is going to be a really large stretch on my point, but perhaps they feel that by getting into the role of the female mind in literature, they would have to enter into a passive space to do that.
Always a possibility. But we've sort of been moving on onto this, and something I've come across quite a lot when researching this topic is the complaints that women authors quite often get. They get labelled with the chick lit label, and that the pictures chosen for their covers are often in pinks and purples and have this feminine context. So do you think that other than just encouraging people to read these women, we also need to encourage the publishers to maybe be a bit more considerate of the various genres women write in rather than just confining them to women's reading?
Yeah, I think that really gets to the point Trudy made earlier, you know, about the importance of that level of action, too, along with this sort of thing. You know, that's why, to me, with the Vita count, the thing that's most interesting to me is how often women are criticized, how often women are written about and reviewed. I think that actually is maybe the most important finding that they have, because it kind of speaks to this patriarchal system that exists. And that's why I think things as simple as reclamation, like what Alex Walker has done with Zora Neale Hurston, can be hugely important. You know, with kind of the work of showing that this isn't a brand new thing, and that there have been like really important works written by women in the canon, and especially ones that aren't as widely thought of, you know, that aren't kind of the hallmark ones that are pointed at over and over again, as good as those might be as well.
So with these campaigns, are we targeting the publishers? Do you think we need to target the publishers, or should more people be targeting the readers, the non-readers? Is there an age limit on who we can start to suggest maybe let's think a bit differently on these things?
Well, I think the problem that this is addressing is not limited to publishing. This is more how society views the value of women and the value of men. It would be ideal if these campaigns would make those sort of changes, but as you know, historically, these changes are very slow.
Women as a whole in America may have to suffer because of their gender. Literally suffer. I don't suffer in the way that some women suffer economically and physically because of gender. And I think we can't really forget that the literary arts are a small and very refined segment of culture. So not to downplay this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of where
you're
going? That's
exactly, and much more eloquent than I was going to go.
Can I go back to your question about covers for just
a
second?
Of course, go straight back.
Because it made me think of something. I have a friend who published a novel, and her novel is about Africa. It's about a historical novel set in Africa. And it's a first novel. It's a solid literary novel. And the publishers decided to, and there is a love story in it, but there's a love story in a lot of novels, right? And the publishers decided to market it as something approximating a historical romance. So the cover is this cover that has this woman in a 19th century gown and sort of a windswept, grassy plain, and it looks like the cover of many historical romances. And I'm sure she was delighted. I know she was delighted to have her novel published and probably happy to a degree with the cover. But when I looked at it, I thought, why is this being presented this way when this isn't really what the story is about? So I think there is sometimes a problem when published, and it's not just for women authors, it's just for authors in general, when the publisher wants to market a book in a niche that they are pretty sure they can sell it in, but it doesn't necessarily fit there. The author can run into problems. You know, the reviews may not be, the readers may not be positive about the book because they were sold something that isn't what they expected, etc. So that's just an observation about that.
I've actually come to notice there's a big difference in covers between the US versions and the UK versions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I've got to admit, I think the US versions are more on the romance chick lit side of things.
Cheesier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying by any means that the UK would anywhere be perfect. I mean, the Vita figures have shown that this is not just a trend within the United States, but we're more likely to just have landscapes and flowers for women's ones in the UK, but rather than a whimsical female staring longingly into the distance, shall we say. Just a personal observation. So where can we go from here? Big open question. Anyone got ideas how to save the world?
Well, one thing to me, a very specific thing that's quite exciting, is this organization, SheBooks. Have you seen this?
No.
It's launched by Laura Fraser and Peggy Northrup in January. They publish short literary ebooks for women, and their ad is something like, "We respect your time," you know, stories women want to read. And I've read a number of these. They're long, short story, novella length. They're both fiction and nonfiction. To me, this is really inspiring. I've been sad for a long time that there aren't any women's magazines anymore that publish fiction, and there are only a couple, I think, that announce themselves as feminist journals that publish fiction. And this seems to be taking on that role that women's magazines were playing, I don't know, 30 or 40 years ago. I can't remember now. But this was one of the things that's excited me most in recent years in terms of women and publishing.
I think another really great model is sort of, and I really love these works, the second wave feminist sci-fi works that happened in sort of the 70s or 60s and 70s. Ursula Le Guin and, you know, Margaret Atwood, who's, you know, still publishing lots today, and Octavia Butler.
Yeah.
And really, it's really interesting the way they kind of worked into that genre, especially Le Guin. Like, her first novels were sort of the high action, high romance things that you would expect from that genre, with a very stereotypical Conan the Barbarian style hero, slightly more intellectual than that, but along those lines. And then, you know, not long after, she's publishing things like Left Hand of Darkness, mm-hmm. as being as well received and as well read in the genre community. So, you know, I think similarly that's happening in the young adult genre now, and I'm really interested in that. I think it's also happening in sort of the not so literary young adult genre in interesting ways, where there's more and more kind of writing by women. You know, silly things, silly is the wrong word, but things like the Star Wars extended universe that are very pulp, you know, read for pleasure above all else. And, you know, there's lots of kind of female voices being found there as well. And I think that's pretty interesting. And it's sort of playing off of that role that I think second wave feminism had in sci-fi, which is still something that's sort of an ongoing interjection into the science fiction genre. But it's working, I think. I think there's more and more female readers of science fiction, women readers of science fiction, and women writers of science fiction.
I think when it becomes more normal for boys to identify with a female protagonist, we'll see probably more changes. Not that women don't sometimes write male protagonists, because they often do, but they often write female protagonists. And so as younger kids can learn that it's okay, as, you know, growing up female, you know, before the second wave, it was always okay to identify with a male protagonist because that was the norm. But, you know, where our ideas about, well, even in my children's generation, ideas about gender and gender preferences and sexual preferences are all becoming looser. And so I think it will be a little easier for boys to identify with women and think that it's okay to read women, and to read about women and understand their experience.
I think also privileging women voices, not just in literary spaces, but, you know, women as a part of history, not just what the men have done, even though the men are at the forefront because they've always been in positions of power, but what the women were doing perhaps on the sideline, but also a lot of very, you know, influential women figures are not taught to young children, and they're not collected in the Norton anthology, which, you know, is sort of a basic primer for at least college age students of like what they should be looking at and what is important. We're telling them what is important, and the implicit message is male voices are important and male action is important. But even in the sciences as well, I mean, can we name off the top of our head like 5 female scientists that are not Marie Curie? The only person that I could add, Ada Lovelace. No, she was not. What was her name?
Ada.
Yeah, that's right.
That is? Okay. But I mean, there are all these women who are doing things, and we don't really hear about them. And I wonder, you know, why are we not hearing about them, and why aren't we teaching young children about this? I mean, if we change the narrative of in schools about what is important to them, then they're not going to grow up. I mean, this is very idealistic, I apologize, but they're not going to grow up with these strong gender, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Roles.
Strong gender roles. And I think the blurring of the lines could possibly happen, maybe organically.
So, blurring of the lines, gender roles, do we just need to stop, just have the author's surname on the spine? We've spoken about the George Eliot, like, changing their name and how that's helped them to become accepted. Would we notice if we took away the first names that are the ones that define?
It's going to be very hard for all the Smith authors in the world.
Well, I think this is another aspect of the way that people are now promoting authors, that the author has become even more important than formerly. What the author looks like, where the author lives, what the author likes to drink when they go out with their girlfriends. And I think that's one of the freedoms of genre writers, because they're not under so much pressure to define this individual static self that can become an icon for their work. And gender is very important to creating that icon, and sexuality is very important to creating that icon.
So, since we're encouraging everyone to read women for 2014, does anyone have any suggestions, burning suggestions, of who anyone who's listening would like to try, might be able to try?
There's a million, but you know, absolutely a million. But 2 books that have really interested me in the past couple of years. One is We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver, and the other is Gone Girl. And I've found both books interesting because, number one, they're both highly intelligent. You know, the authors are intelligent, the books are intelligent. And number two, you could make an argument with each of them that either this is a feminist book or this is an anti-feminist book. We Need to Talk About Kevin, you have a mother who is a withdrawn, distant, didn't want her child. And did this cause the son, Kevin, to become a monster and a mass murderer? That seems to be what the story is telling us. And you have a very unlikable and semi-unreliable narrative voice. And I think that's very interesting. And then with Gone Girl, you have this sort of layered narrative where it's being told by both Nick and Amy. And Amy, again, is not a very likable character, but Amy has also been terribly objectified by her parents, who have turned her into a book character that they've made their fortune on. So, and there's a lot more, you know, in that novel about the relationship between husband and wife. And in both books, you have this problem of, you know, a strong woman character who's married and the problems that the marriage encounters because of power differences between men and women. So I think they're really interesting novels, and I would encourage anybody to read them. And I think, do novels speak to men and women? You know, I mean, I think anybody could read both and find them extremely interesting and provocative.
One that I think I mean, this is maybe not the flashiest answer because it's somebody that everybody knows already, but Toni Morrison's Home for me is something that I think people should be reading. When she was writing it, her editors kept asking for more and more and more, and I think it's kind of a really interesting counterpoint as a really short, very well put together novel to the giant, sprawling, often somewhat male novels, male associated novels, like the Jonathan Franzen novel, to point to someone specifically. And she wouldn't. She wanted it to be short. She wanted it to be, almost small enough to be read in a sitting. And to me, it's an absolute masterpiece. And a really, if people are looking for that clear masterpiece that's maybe a counterpoint to some of those quote unquote masterpieces, I think it's a really good one. And I think it also has a lot to say. It's a novel with a male protagonist, but also goes into some female voices over the course of the novel. And I think it has a lot to say about gender and sexuality, and takes a historical look at those in America, which I think, and race as well, which, there's no need to limit it entirely. So I think it's great that it's taking on so much in such a short space.
I would recommend Alyssa Nutting's Tampa, partially because it's still on my mind. I read it about 4 months ago. And I think not only just the novel itself, which everyone says that it's very brave because you have a female sociopath who, has sexual relations with her young underage students, but it's interesting that everyone says that it's brave, and I don't think that anyone told Bret Easton Ellis that he was so brave in coming up with Patrick Bateman. But something about exploring female monstrousness is courageous in some way, and why? So it's also very, very odd novel. I love it.
I'm on a mission to get people to go back and read Catherine Ann Porter. I think she's one of the writers who is so neglected. I teach her every chance I can possibly teach her. She wrote The Flowering Judas back in the 20s, and she wrote about women's sexuality, women as revolutionaries, women as artists, women and men disputing about their domestic responsibilities, urban women, and their relationship with their male colleagues. And people tend to think that all these issues that women are facing are very new, but actually, you can go back to the beginning of the 20th century, you can go back to the 19th century. So I think it'd be a great idea for people to go back and read someone like Catherine Ann Porter, or more recently, Mary Gaitskell's Bad Behavior and late 80s broke a lot of sexual boundaries and still tells us a lot about sexuality and gender. And then, of course, Kathy Acker, who is an outrageous writer who takes the classics of literature like The Scarlet Letter and defaces them. And her works are full of obscenity, but they're also, they're very painful because they're about the traumas that gender bias has wrought on us.
Great. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for helping out.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast, music by Mark Catalano. Check us out online at MissouriReview.com. There you can subscribe to the magazine, follow our Poem of the Week feature, and enter our 2014 Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize with $5,000 cash prizes in poetry, fiction, and essay. Thanks for listening, and check back next week for a new episode of the Missouri Review Sound Booth Podcast.